This episode of Connect the Dots is brought to you by the Center for Progressive Reform. Our podcast is supported in part by the Center on Environment, Land, and Law at Loyola University, New Orleans. On the road toward energy justice, there are a lot of drivers of change, and we've been talking about some of them this season. Now, some are racing forward. Others are dawdling in the right lane, and others are hitting a few speed bumps or obstacles along the way. You got to admit that in the last 4 years, we saw some pretty frenetic drivers out there. But in 2021, with a new presidential administration in power, the path is beginning to clear again. President Biden put climate front and center while he was campaigning, and he wasted no time in pushing his agenda when he took office. The president has proposed $14 billion in spending on initiatives to fight the crisis in the nation's 2022 budget. And he's appointed cabinet officials with strong and informed backgrounds on all of the matters to offer guidance in this area. He's also supporting tax incentives to favor clean energy over fossil fuels, and he's promised to spur a job revolution that will protect workers in the new energy sector. But wait, we have three branches of government, and the president on his own can only do so much. On top of that, we have 50 states, all with governors and lawmakers and judges who have to agree. And we've got all those local governments, too. So how do all those plans and all those politicians fit together? Some states are cruising along, others are on a bumpy drive. How does it all add up? And what all should be taken into consideration when the roadmaps are drawn?
It's very helpful to have a federal government that is not denying climate change, is actually active in providing opportunities or venues for us to do something about the climate crisis.
A clean energy transition is going to require planning and democratic deliberation and coordination, right? There are too many different things going on for us to be able to do it or to achieve equitable and effective transition without those components.
We have states like New Mexico and New York saying we've got to get there in the next 15, 20 years. But despite these aggressive mandates, when you look at the actual regulatory process for approving the technologies we need to get there, it's slowing things down.
One of the challenges in leaving this to a market approach is that the market is not responsive to a racial equity agenda. There has to be a lot of intentionality.
I mean, the climate movement is pretty simple to us. All we want is our lives and our futures.
You're listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast produced by the Center for Progressive Reform. This season, we take on energy justice. I'm your host, Rob Virchik. On today's episode, we are looking at what government is doing at all levels on the road to clean energy and energy justice. What are the steps that we need to take in order to get where we need to go? And how will we know that we're heading in the right direction? In his first month in office, President Biden signed an executive order that put the climate crisis on the front burner. Among some of the initiatives, climate disruption was made central to national security and to foreign policy. The U.S. rejoined the Paris Agreement, which urges nations to achieve net zero emissions by 2050. And the president established a national climate task force, as well as the Office of Climate Change and Health Equity. In addition, the administration set aims to achieve a carbon-free electricity sector no later than 2035. And he promised to take care of workers by creating well-paying union jobs and building infrastructure for a sustainable economy. Guiding these decisions, the president pledged to use environmental justice as a lens for policymaking. To the surprise of some, he is using his executive authority to put the kibosh on fossil fuel subsidies that are within his control. In April, Biden announced his new tax plan, which included specific incentives for clean energy production as a replacement for fossil fuel subsidies. These economic changes were designed to encourage green technologies like electric vehicles or wind and solar generated electricity. There's also a 10-year production tax and investment tax credit for clean energy generation and storage, and fines for polluting entities, depending on the damages they create. Overall, the plan appears to be comprehensive and goal-oriented. There's a destination we're heading towards, a number of measures for how we can get there, and a team of people guiding the journey. Still, states establish their own measures for fitting into the national agenda. And don't forget the private sector. There are some businesses hoping to make a lot of money converting to a green economy, while others are in danger of being left out if they don't get their act together. Looking at you, Exxon. Ellis Kaswan, a member scholar of CPR and a professor and associate dean at the University of San Francisco, happens to be an expert on all these matters. She specializes in climate federalism. That's the relationship between the federal and the state government systems. And she looks at how the roles of the federal, state, and local governments come together to address the climate crisis.
I think having a federalist system where we have a federal, a state, local jurisdictions is immensely complicated and immensely challenging, but also has or create certain opportunities. So I think there are important roles for all. I think government works best when it is operating at multiple levels. We need federal frameworks. We need federal resources. We need federal research. We need federal principles and guidelines. But I also think that it's important to have aspects of climate policy that are implemented at more of a state or a local level where you're closer to the variations that distinguish different parts of our country, where you're closer to the voices of people who may want to have some input into the shape of the many different facets of climate policy that may affect them. And so I guess the question is, when and where is that planning appropriate? What I think the federal push needs to be, your planning needs to be to move to zero, and your planning needs to be thinking about how to achieve multi-pollutant objectives and how to address financial burdens.
The $14 billion budget request Biden made this spring includes about a 10% funding increase for the Energy Department, the Interior Department, and the Environmental Protection Agency. The request is a stark contrast to President Trump's budget requests. Last year, Trump had proposed a 26% cut to the EPA and an elimination of 50 of the agency's programs. The Biden administration's tax plan not only advances clean electricity production, but also adds an incentive for long-distance transmission lines to enhance the movement of electricity from clean energy generators. By eliminating subsidies for fossil fuel companies, the Treasury estimates that the government could save more than $35 billion in the coming decade. An example of one of these subsidies would be something called intangible drilling costs. These allow oil producers to deduct costs from drilling new wells. Getting rid of that alone could generate $13 billion over 10 years. All that savings could be put towards innovation, things like electric vehicles, sustainable aviation fuel, and electric appliances. The bigger question, though, is how do states implement these new systems within their own plans in a way that stimulates the private market? It's something I discussed with Hannah Wiseman, a CPR member scholar and a law professor at the College of Earth and Mineral Sciences and Institutes of Energy and the Environment at Penn State University.
It's interesting, the different timelines toward renewables that we're seeing, right? Because governments are aggressively pursuing zero carbon. We have states like New Mexico and New York saying we've got to get there in the next 15, 20 years, or we've got to get close to it, right? But despite these aggressive mandates, when you look at the actual regulatory process for approving the technologies we need to get there, it's slowing things down. And it's slowing down innovative business solutions because business does operate on more of an aggressive timeline. Let's get this project done. I think there's a growing clash between the innovative, independent efforts on the parts of businesses and the regulatory framework. Now we need these regulations. I'm not saying we should jettison the environmental review that has to occur for any type of project, whether it's a renewable energy project or another one. But I think governments need to think more creatively about solutions that would support faster approval of clean energy. And I think states like New York provide a good example there. So New York is proposing build-ready renewable projects where the developer could just come to the newly formed state commission and there'd be a project ready for that developer. The siting permits, they're all there. It's basically a turnkey operation. That's what I think business would like.
To tackle some of these questions and conflicts of interest, President Biden set up a diverse and respected team of people to lead the mission, including one of CPR's own former member scholars, Shalonda Baker, a nominee for director of the Office of Minority Impact at the Department of Energy. Biden's team also includes the first ever U.S. presidential envoy for climate, a position held by John Kerry. A team like that can be inspiring, as I learned from Flozell Daniels Jr. He's CEO and president of the Foundation for Louisiana and a former public policy specialist for the city of New Orleans.
I think your people say a lot about who you are. And what we've seen so far is an administration that's appointed some of the best and brightest minds who have an equity framework. Some of them have learned it over years from being involved. Others came out the gate as activists who now are proximal to the administration. That's really exciting for a lot of us. We know some of these folks. That tells us we're going to have people on the inside really doing the tough work of debating these issues and making sure we show up. I think the other thing we're excited about is a clear indication the Biden administration and the federal government is going to push for a kind of man to the moon approach on these climate issues. They understand that it's going to take a significant public investment, not only financially, but also from a policy change and an enforcement perspective, bringing the full weight of the federal government to bear on these issues in ways that are going to be critically important for localities and states who have an equitable climate agenda but don't necessarily have the political support for it. Having the enforcement arm of the federal government, as well as the financial resources to not only shift us into the use of more renewables in the infrastructure, but to also push for behavior change.
It's important for federal, state, and local governments to take a stand on the climate crisis because without that support and investment, those on the ground doing the work will lack the resources and the public momentum to perform their work. There would be far fewer people worried about offsetting their carbon footprint right now if there were no consequences. It's also crucial that we have a clean plan or direction, as these issues are complicated and they're always changing. They're always evolving. It's not just the government and it's not just the markets. They both have to work together. We met Laura Zapata on our last episode. She's the founder and CEO of Clearloop, an organization that works with businesses to offset carbon emissions by investing in solar farms. From her perspective, without a lot of government backing, her work becomes nearly impossible.
It's very helpful to have a federal government that is not denying climate change, is actually active in providing opportunities or venues for us to do something about the climate crisis. It shouldn't be sort of a political football issue. There are lots of little tiny regulations that can make it easier or harder for innovators and entrepreneurs and private sector actors to be able to interact with these utilities or the local governments. And so everything from bank regulations, making it easier for banks to be able to invest and finance some of these projects and see that it's not just for the renewable energy, but also for the community impact aspects of being able to build new infrastructure. We were talking early about the difference between putting a marker, sort of a goal with some sort of standard. It's been much easier or much more helpful to have the little pieces of regulations that make it easier for both the businesses and the utilities to be able to invest or take this power.
How those policies and regulations are laid out can be really challenging. Some things can be addressed immediately, We can make households more efficient right now. States can start purchasing more green energy immediately. Other things are going to take a lot longer. We are just starting to build offshore wind farms, for instance. And while we've got huge potential in that area as a country, it's going to take several years for a lot of that potential to be developed and put online. You've also got to think about how communities are going to be affected, which industries need the most regulation, and how to divide the work between the public sector, the private sector, and the nonprofit sector. For Flocel Daniels, it's about getting the right people at the table at the right time.
Whether it's with energy or transportation or labor or EDA, across the board, we're hearing narratives about climate and the expectation that they're going to do their part and play an important role in not only reducing emissions, but moving us into a 21st century climate approach, understanding that we're going to need the entirety of the public sector policy framework to help us achieve those goals. This idea of historic disparities, that's such an important thing to remember. We always say in this work, particularly in the South, memory matters. We have to really understand, how did we get here? And one of the ways we got here is broad-scale public investment that was intentionally inequitable, whether it's redlining from a housing perspective, where energy infrastructure was developed, we could go on and on, making sure that Black and Indigenous and people of color and poor people and people who have been traditionally dispossessed of political power were left out of those investments. They were left out of the access conversation and certainly left out of the control discussion. And so I think looking at those disparities and adjusting forward-looking policy for them, maintaining affordability, making sure that communities increasingly have control, and looking at how we educate ourselves, not only about this history, but about ways of going forward and what does it take to do that. Lower energy use, and most importantly, renewable energy use. We just have to normalize this. I think we're going to have to utilize at-scale approaches, right? One of the challenges in leaving this to a market approach is that the market is not responsive to a racial equity agenda. There has to be a lot of intentionality.
A starting point for equitably moving forward would be, as I mentioned, to focus on energy efficiency. A lot of older houses and older apartment buildings leak like sieves. They're expensive to cool in the summertime, and they're expensive to keep warm in the wintertime. In housing like that, the utility bills are really high. A lot of those households are low income or near low income. Now, we have made a lot of progress in that area. Energy consumption in the United States and related emissions would be about 60% higher today if not for efficiency gains over the past 40 years, which has saved consumers $800 billion annually on their energy bills. But we can do a lot more, and it is one of the cheapest and quickest ways to move the climate needle. The International Energy Agency, for instance, projects that energy efficiency, just using the existing technology that we have, could account for nearly half of emissions reductions needed to meet the goals of the Paris Climate Accord. On top of that, the energy efficiency sector is one of the largest energy workforces in the United States, with more than 2 million employees across the country. Think of all those people installing insulation, replacing windows, linking up new water heaters. That's a lot of work, and there's opportunity there, as Alice Kazwan sees it.
Energy efficiency and many of the other components of a clean energy transition will be job creators. And I think we have, you know, a couple of categories of people who are going to need work as we look at a clean energy economy. So one is the people who've always needed work, communities that have high levels of unemployment, where there have been gaps in providing quality education that have kept people behind, thinking here about issues of structural racism and segregation and the way in which that's impacted education in many parts of the country. And that has led to differing opportunities to obtain employment and obtain training. And so I think being able to think about this energy transition and the need to train people to do new kinds of work is an opportunity to direct some of those opportunities to the places where people have been left behind. The other dimensions are about considering potential burdens of an energy transition for people who are poor. We are concerned about rising costs of energy potentially, and there are a variety of ways that could occur. There may be transition period costs, right, as we work our transmission, as we rework our capital investments in new technologies for generating energy. So there may be transition costs, even though in the long term, some of these may be cheaper forms of energy. And also, we may have people who have means going off the grid, people installing solar and paying less into our traditional utilities that may leave the people who can't afford to get solar holding the bag, essentially, mm-hmm. of the stranded costs for the utilities. So we have to be very careful about making sure that we are addressing what we often call that energy burden, costs of clean energy, and how they impact people with the fewest resources, who already spend more on energy as a proportion of their income than people who are wealthier.
We can also look at how we regulate companies that produce fossil fuels. Carbon pricing is one way to do that, making it more expensive to emit greenhouse gases. This is a more market-based approach. That's where you place a fee on a fossil fuel, like gasoline, for instance, and that fee is based on the cost of the harm that that fossil fuel is creating for the climate. There's also something called a cap and trade program. In that scenario, the government puts a cap on all emissions around the country, for instance, and companies can buy and sell allowances that allow them to emit certain amounts of carbon dioxide or other greenhouse gases within that cap structure. The idea is that every year or few years, that cap would gradually be brought down, so emissions over time would incrementally decrease as the energy sector moved away from fossil fuel. In a system like that, the price would fluctuate with supply and demand.
Carbon pricing is privatized, so we have a price signal, and a carbon price just can hit the ground running, right? The moment you set it is the moment that it starts working. But I don't think it can or should be very high, because I think that could lead to a lot of energy justice concerns right off the bat. And so I don't think it should be the primary mechanism, but there should be a price that sends that ongoing incentive and creates a sort of backstop of, like, no matter what's going on in our regulatory policies and our various strategies, we either have a cap or we have a steady tax that's going to keep things moving.
With all these policies, it's not one size fits all. We've discussed how renewable energy innovations like solar panels or electric vehicles, they may not be affordable for many people. This problem can be addressed through subsidies or grants, but if you think about establishing a law that requires the use of these sources, it would need to take into account a wide variety of factors, even the weather.
Building codes would be one practical example. So we want to have every state adopt building codes, because we need to think about the role of buildings in reducing emissions. We have to have a federal role. But at the same time, we have very different weather patterns around the country. So I think this is a very visceral example, right? So there are places where you're really going to have to worry about air conditioning, and there are other places where you have to worry about it less. You want to be able to offer a tailored approach. Even within communities, if you're thinking about climate strategies, in some places, your focus will be on existing homes and how do you retrofit existing homes, because you don't have a big market in new and you have a lot of old, and a lot of them may be very leaky. And so your priority may want to be thinking about strategies for existing buildings. In other areas, you may have a lot of new growth, or you may have a housing or commercial stock that needs replacement soon, and you may be more focused on putting your energy and resources into setting requirements for new. I think it's essential to have federal frameworks, that the federal government require state and local governments to be working on adaptation, because it's something that's going to affect, I think, every part of the country to at least some degree. But the actual impacts are going to vary tremendously by local areas.
Then there's the matter of utilities and the transmission lines. Now, imagine there's a lot of wind in South Dakota, which is true. And imagine that you have a lot of wind farms in South Dakota. Now, you're generating all this electricity, and you need to send that electricity to more populous areas. And in order to do that, you need more high-voltage transmission lines. Right? So that's one issue, in order to get that power somewhere else. Now, imagine you wanted to sell that power, that energy, to a state like Utah or Colorado. Okay, so you would need those transmission lines that we talked about. But then another challenge you'd find is that as you sent that energy through the lines of other states, you might have to pay different transmission rates depending on the state that your electricity was flowing through. That's because states control their own rates, and often they're not coordinated with one another. That's particularly true in the Intermountain West. So for every state that your electricity crosses, you need to stack a different rate on top of the total transmission fees. That's something that we call rate pancaking. So the need for more lines and the lack of coordination among states causing rate pancaking are two challenges that worry Hannah Weisman.
If we want 100% renewables or other clean energy, we need a massive amount of new transmission infrastructure. Now that poses huge challenges in and of itself, environmental justice very high up there, right? I mean, they're going to be very important conflicts in terms of siting these lines with and making sure that the impacts on communities and wildlife are as low as possible. But if we assume that we can double or triple our transmission network, which is what will be required if we want to go to 100% renewables, if we can assume we can do that in an environmentally sensitive way, the main impediments are the siting laws, which are on a state-by-state basis. So states can just deny the construction of a transmission line through their state, even though it's running through multiple states. And then on the regulatory side, it's also a business problem. So if we manage to construct the line and overcome the hurdles to the siting of it at the state level, there's still the problem of multiple different utilities owning the wire. And here is where the regulators have tried to come up with a solution. Individual utilities that own all the different transmission lines hand over the control of those wires to one entity. And that is key because it avoids what's called rate pancaking, which otherwise occurs, which is if you have to transport your electricity through lots of different utilities' wires, they're going to be charging different rates for the use of those wires. And it's really complicated to make that transaction. Now, even some regions where there aren't RTOs, they're trying to harmonize the transmission rates such that this rate pancaking issue is not such a big deal.
Believe it or not, the first electric vehicle appeared in the year 1890. A chemist in Iowa named William Morrison invented a 6-passenger vehicle capable of moving about 14 miles an hour on a good day. Hey, not bad, right? And electric cars, it turns out, had a pretty solid run until the early 1900s. And that was when the gasoline-powered engine was born. And then came the Model T. And after that, electric vehicles, or EVs, became a thing of the past. Unless you like golfing. But now they've become a thing of the future. And that's when the Prius came along in 1997. And it was, in the beginning, you might remember, it was trendy, it was eco-friendly, and a little bit more expensive than your average Toyota. And way back, people who drove Priuses, or maybe Prii, anyway, whatever you call them, people who drove them were sometimes thought of as really with it and helping the environment, and sometimes they were just considered pretentious. I still drive a Prius. I got it way back. I even got a new license plate that said Clean Air, CLNAIR. True story, I got stopped a while back for speeding, and that license plate actually got me out of a speeding ticket. The police officer told me he was sad about how we were treating the planet. Anyway, today, EVs, or electric vehicles, are a thing now. Not just to be cool or conscientious, but to save the planet. However, it needs to be about more than just a few cars on the road, and a lot more than just virtue signaling. What's more, everybody, regardless of geography or income, should be able to access electrified transportation and make good use of it. That is possible, but it's going to require some pretty sophisticated coordination between government and private markets. Again, here's Hannah Weisman.
One important component of getting to net zero carbon emissions in the United States, in fact, one of the most important components, is the vehicle sector, because the largest percentage of carbon emissions in the United States comes from transportation. This burdens urban communities in particular, especially urban low-income communities that, in addition to all the emissions from cars, are experiencing emissions from industry power plants, because that's where all of the stationary sources of air pollution are located. We have the carbon problem, but we also have smog, the nitrous oxides and the other components of smog that are contributing to asthma, to early deaths, to many hospitalizations. If we're in the business of subsidizing electric vehicles, we focus those subsidies on low-income communities, as well as the charging infrastructure subsidies, because of course an electric vehicle is useless without the plug. And right now, electric vehicles just aren't affordable for people in the low-income sector. We need subsidization beyond just you get a tax credit, right? We might need upfront rebates or just direct grants for the purchasing of electric vehicles. We need more investment in electric vehicle research so the price goes down, because right now they're just still too expensive for the average consumer, or most of them are.
Now, we've talked before about cleaning up our transportation system. And while electrification is the biggest chunk of the solution, there are other options too. Hydrogen is something that people are talking about, because hydrogen can power trucks and cars, and notably, airplanes. Smaller ones thus far, but that's a big deal, because airplanes are one of the things that are very hard, right, to electrify. Now, using hydrogen can help us reduce greenhouse gases depending upon how that hydrogen is produced. Today, we talk about the environmental benefit of a hydrogen by giving it a color, like M&Ms, right? So there's gray, blue, and green. Now, it's the same stuff, but the color we assign it helps us remember how it was created. So most hydrogen we use today, 99% of it, is produced for industrial use. And it's derived from natural gas through a process that emits harmful greenhouse gases. So today's cheap, traditional, gray hydrogen would be the kind that we want to avoid. Now, if you make hydrogen using natural gas, and instead of emitting those greenhouse gases into the air, you capture them in an industrial process and then store that captured carbon underground in perpetuity, you're getting the same hydrogen, but keeping the carbon out of the air, which is a good thing, but has some risks to it. And we talked about that in the last episode. That kind of hydrogen is called blue hydrogen. Blue is more expensive than gray, but better for the environment from the point of view of greenhouse gases. Now, there's a third way of creating hydrogen that doesn't use natural gas at all. You basically use seawater and a process called electrolysis, which you can power from a renewable energy source like solar panels. And that process creates hydrogen without generating any carbon at all, whether it's carbon that's emitted into the air or carbon that has to be stored underground. That's called green hydrogen, and it's very much cleaner, but at the present time, it is 2 to 3 times more expensive than run-of-the-mill gray hydrogen. But there is a lot of potential there. Before the pandemic, I was visiting in Australia, for instance, talking to energy and electricity experts. And there are some companies that are really excited about the ability in coastal Australia to take advantage of all that seawater and all that sunlight and use that electrolysis process to produce green hydrogen, which they could then transport by ship anywhere in the world. One official told me she thought of it as a way to ship solar power. The thing about green hydrogen, though, or blue hydrogen for that matter, is that though it's better for the environment, it's more expensive. And so we run into the question about who is going to pay for it. Producing green hydrogen at scale is really complicated. But as Hannah says, it's not impossible. It also might appeal to more conservative folks who are uncomfortable with massive change.
We need to think so far beyond electrify everything. That's not going to work for a huge portion of the population, in part for the psychological and just day-to-day factors that make people not want to rely on electricity for something like their vehicle. In addition to concerns about they can't fix it themselves, there still is range anxiety. I own an electric vehicle, and I still worry when I'm driving with my kids. Well, what if I don't make it to the charger, right? I think we need to think more about diversifying fuels in a way that ensures reliability. I think there's growing attention to these green and blue fuels, but then of course people are very afraid of hydrogen. In the electric car front, a lot of low-income rural consumers, I think, will vehemently resist electrification. There's this American passion for the internal combustion engine, which I kind of understand, right? I mean, it's baked into our culture. So you tell a farmer, right, you can't go out in your tractor anymore that's powered by diesel. That's a major psychological transition. So yeah, we just need to think so much more creatively about low carbon. And I think we need to think well beyond just electrify.
Alice Caswan points out the problems that might occur with establishing a national norm that doesn't always meet local parameters.
I think we really need to look at our grid and think about what we're going to do about electricity and transmission and electric cars. So all those things kind of need to be thought about together at some level. That's the kind of large-scale planning that needs to occur. But I also think there's a huge role at a more local level. So I do think the efforts to integrate economic and environmental and climate concerns will require some degree of more localized planning. States may want to look at where they have the most problems from certain electricity sources, right? Where do they have the coal plant that is actually causing a lot of health concerns in nearby neighborhoods? Or where do they have a concentration that they want to unconcentrate at some level? And so I think what I would like to see, and this is something that was a feature of the Obama administration's Clean Power Plan, was that we were setting federal expectations for every state, but then states were having to come up with plans. The plans were, I'd say, a little bit weak on the environmental justice front, but I think that at the same time, they talked about it at least, and maybe the Biden administration could go farther in saying that we want multi-pollutant planning in each state for envisioning how you're going to move forward to reduce emissions.
As we embark on our planning and implementation of clean energy policies, the transition for the American worker in this sector ranks high on the list of priorities in terms of equity and justice. President Biden has promised the transition to clean energy will create millions of good-paying union jobs. He promises up to 10 million jobs specifically. It's a pretty lofty goal. A 2020 report from the Environmental Entrepreneurs found that before the pandemic, 3.4 million Americans worked in clean energy. That's solar, wind, energy, efficiency, clean vehicles, and more. For Biden to reach just a million new clean energy jobs in his first 4 years, there would need to be a yearly increase of 6.7%. And it's not only the government's task to fulfill that. There are many ways to provide new roles and employment within this movement. It requires strategy and training, but with a lot to be done, there is the need for a lot of people to do it. Laura Zapata explains Clear Loop's strategy as they advance towards building their first solar farm.
We have the land. So it's about 12 acres of land right across from the technical college there in Jackson, who are already training electricians. Solar projects bring a lot of construction jobs, but we want to make sure that there's other skills, having more involvement in workforce development so that, you know, once these projects become sort of the norm in the South and in the Midwest, that our own workforce can actually plug in and work in those places. And so what we're working with them through is trying to figure out how do we make sure that the folks who are already getting trained as electricians are also getting to plug in to the solar project and they get a certification. But then sort of longer term thinking about what is the opportunity with the school system. There's already sort of a pathway and some connections with the technical college. So how can we get to these students earlier and sort of work through a curriculum that allows them to see that there's a lot more in this new renewable energy economy that they should also have access to. And so we want to bring it home to them by making this facility sort of the anchoring for some of these other community investments that will be coming up.
And in all the big decision making and executive orders, we can't forget one of the driving spirits of the new environmental movement, young people. Remember Wendy Gao? Wendy lobbied her local government to install solar panels across county buildings in Fairfax, Virginia, and she went on to lead the youth environmental nonprofit Earth Uprising. She feels a close connection to Biden after campaigning for him last year during the elections. She's also adamant that her constituency should not be left out of future policy discussions.
There were a ton of youth activists that were involved in pushing him to set more aggressive targets, adopt more aggressive legislation, and, you know, part of the creation of, you know, the environmental justice priorities and a lot of the new positions. We were involved in a lot of that. So we were very included in those discussions, and climate was a huge part of Biden's campaign, and we all helped him, you know, get elected. But now we're finding that we're starting to be excluded from the discussions a little bit, where we had expected to be more included. So a lot of youth are now pushing for him to form a federal youth climate council, because ultimately we are going to be most affected by climate change. Because we're younger, we're going to be living on the planet more. It's our future. And because of that, we deserve a seat at the table. And also, we helped elect him. We helped craft this policy. So we deserve to be involved in seeing those out and the actual implementation of that.
That said, Wendy seems pleased with Biden's efforts so far, particularly when it comes to environmental and energy justice. She credits his work canceling the Houston pipeline, pausing the issuance of new leases for drilling on public lands and offshore, and establishing a climate envoy. All of those are some of his highest achievements in her eyes. With continued youth involvement along the way, Wendy believes more milestones will be met.
There definitely is generational differences. And I think the biggest one and the most apparent one that I've seen is I just think that the youth are not as patient or not as tolerant as adults. Just in general, adults, I think, are more jaded and a little bit more cynical and slow to act and demand change and or even start to believe that change is possible. So, you know, they tolerate more. They're a little bit more willing to deal with politics. Like, think about when you were a kid, like when you wanted something like a toy or a dessert, like you wanted it right then and there. And that's kind of what the youth movement is. Like, we're demanding immediate climate action and environmental justice because we want it now. I think we're not quite as corrupted by politics and money. I mean, the climate movement is pretty simple to us. All we want is our lives and our futures. Like, it's not good enough for us to, quote unquote, like transition to cleaner fossil fuels like natural gas. To us, there is a right and there's a wrong here. We're not as willing to put up with shortcuts and cutting corners.
Young people have a way of getting what they want after all. It's that ingenuity and ambition that also inspires Laura Zapata.
When we started Clear Loop, we did not have the background in sustainability and science. And I think that we're going to need more people who come from very different backgrounds and very different perspectives to come in and noodle around and bring their ideas and bring their perspectives. We need more young people and more people of color to come out and dig in and bring their experiences and their ideas, because this has not been figured out. There's lots of room for creativity. There's lots of room for entrepreneurship. And I hope that Clear Loop can show that we are going to need more people to do this. We're not unique in bringing our backgrounds and our tools to the table to try to make a difference and beat back climate crisis.
Thanks for listening to Connect the Dots, a podcast by the Center for Progressive Reform. For information on this episode, please visit our website, progressivereform.org. You can also follow us on Twitter at CPR blog or on Instagram. That's at Progressive Reform, all one word. If you like this podcast, please subscribe and leave us a review. Make sure that you tell your friends and other associates about our podcast. It will help us reach more listeners like you who want to connect the dots in today's most pressing issues. I'd like to thank our guests today, Hannah Wiseman, Alice Kaswan, Flozell Daniels, Laura Zapata, and Wendy Gao. Our producer is Courtney Garcia, and our assistant producer is Brian Gum. Our theme music is by Lobo Loco and Blue Dot Sessions. And I'm Rob Verchik. Until next time, be safe and take care of one another.